We continue now with our look at a model of how energies manifest in human beings and how imbalances may be corrected to allow for a greater wellness as we talk with Solaheen and Alicia Tom, a husband and wife team that uses knowledge of these forces to help heal events that may go way back in one's ancestry. Solaheen and Alicia Tom are originally from Scotland and England, respectively, now live outside of Portland, Oregon. Their new book, co-written with Alexandra Terhorst, is entitled Being Human, Exploring the Forces That Shape Us and Awaken an Inner Life. We left off in our last segment with a discussion of the life forces, and we talked about the noble life force, being at the top of this hierarchy, being in every human, being a force accessible and inside every human, or at least part of it inside. That connection with the noble is certainly inside. Was there anything else on that that you wanted to elaborate on, or should we just move on to a discussion of other things, of your other model, which sort of aids this model?
I think I'd like to sort of add a little bit about the noble life force. In a way, it's really what all of us would like to sort of taste. It's the idea that when we're really in a place of surrender, this life force comes to us. And what it begins to do is to give us noble thoughts and noble actions, and it gives us feelings that are rich and high and again noble. And it also allows us to look at our own bodies and our own facets of who we are and see a nobility in that. So it really is something that lifts us out of our poverty, out of our absence of feeling, if you like, out of our miseries and our pathologies or illnesses, because it gives us hope. And the extraordinary thing is that this life force, which really isn't part of the human, but it is slightly above it, if you like, it's that it comes to us when we open ourselves to it.
It's a very interesting thing in the book that I made a note of to ask you about. And quite often people, to achieve a different state of consciousness, use drugs in one way or another. Mm-hmm. Hallucinogens, perhaps the ayahuasca ritual in South America, or any number of different hallucinogens. This is not the noble life force, is it?
No, it's not. And it's actually very difficult for us to sort of truly explain this without making people sort of feel in a way
here comes
put down.
The religious pitch,
yes,
right?
Yes. And really it's not religious. It's just the idea that it's like this. If I drink some alcohol, which is a sort of vegetable force, actually, and I drink it, what happens is that it changes my nervous system. And as we know with drunks or people who are under the influence of alcohol, that their behavior is never very noble. In fact, it stays, if you like, at the vegetative. It's the animal part of us becomes sort of a bit sloppy. We can't walk a straight line. We may get sick. Certainly the next morning we may feel, uncomfortable. So what we began to understand is that a vegetable force, so a substance, so for example marijuana or any other opiate or whatever, is vegetable. That's its nature. So if I take a vegetable, it can only catalyze me at its own level. It can't actually take me beyond. Now, the reality is, of course, is that the noble life force and the spiritual are at every level of the universe. So yes, we can taste the spiritual taste as if we were a plant. I mean, it's a sort of an obscure idea, but you can't really have a human ennobling experience with a substance that, in fact, its nature is vegetable.
Limiting. Yeah. In each family, there seems to be one person who's committed to a healing path. Obviously, I think I'm the one in the family. And, it's like, oh, great, this person is interested in healing, but all the it's not an easy path, is it? Do you find this to be true?
No, actually.
There might be three or four in some families,
yes.
Right?
I mean, I was always the black sheep, actually. I got four brothers and sisters. My father's a physician. He was into preventive medicine. i.e. the idea of what actually prevents us from going to doctors, actually.
What a concept.
Yes, isn't it? And he did a very good job, but he was much more environmental in terms of looking at the environment and how that affected us and our health. And what I've done is I've looked internally and seen that actually Dad gave me the same sense of what makes us sick, what makes us ill. But turning that around, what I really recognize is that it's not about, you know, the fear of illness or you know, I don't want to be sick, so let's, you know, prevent it. It's actually what it is in me that can rise up and be bigger and better and more in my potential.
What can go up into that chain, that hierarchy that you talked about in the last interview? There's an ancient symbol which the medical profession uses, but few people really understand, the caduceus. It's the winged staff with serpents coiled around, sometimes one, sometimes two snakes coiled around it, the symbol of Hermes. Can you explain the background of this particular symbol and some of the wisdom that goes into it, some that we may have forgotten?
Yes. You've just mentioned the idea that it's actually the symbol of Hermes. Well, it's also the symbol of Mercury. It actually originally came from the Greek god of healing called Asclepius. In fact, it's probably an amalgam of different symbols that we've put together. It has implicit in it the idea of a central axis. Those snakes coiling around it has an implicit sort of iconic representation of movement, of vibration. So it's saying in that central connection there is life, so that's the snakes, and then on top there's a pair of wings that really represent the idea of illumination and reflection and cognition. And what's happened is that in the last century we adopted it into our medical profession, and for most of us, including myself, none of us were really told what the caduceus meant. It was a nice symbol. And the extraordinary thing for us, and I'm speaking both for Lissy and I, is that we were really given an understanding of the caduceus at a very fundamental level. I had a spiritual experience many years ago where I tasted and saw, actually, my own caduceus, but it was a sort of rather broken caduceus. In fact, there was no central staff. The snake was wrapped around my heart, so metaphorically protecting my heart from love and from people getting close to me. And I sort of experienced the idea that my thinking and my sense of illumination, so the wings, were as if I had a pair of broken wings. So in a way, what I experienced was I was someone who was grounded, who couldn't fly off, who couldn't fly off the ground and look at something from a distance or from a different point of view. And that this snake, which really represents life and animation and rhythm, was in fact tightly coiled around my heart, making sure that actually I wasn't very alive.
And this sort of, I guess, personal mythology, if you will, or challenge that you had, manifests on a very superficial level, a very basic level, as a person who walks around hunched over. You were talking about this. I had a bit of you're talking about a healing experience with your father where mm-hmm. he was having that, and well, it being at 80 some years old, you can understand him being hunched over, and then for the next 18 months you were hunched over.
Yes, you've sort of taken a story that I had said. What had happened very briefly was that I had come home, it's not really my home, but gone back to my father's home, and noticed that he'd hurt his back playing golf. And as a physician, I decided that I would help Dad, and so I did. I held his back, and as an osteopath, basically helped him. But I sort of, probably in retrospect, rather egotistically thought, let's see if I can do something better than this. And I did some acupuncture on his chest. And the reason why is that Dad's rather hunched over, and really recognized that same pattern of a heart that's protected, it was really what he hunches over. So I gave him some acupuncture, and I felt a release in his body. And, you know, he didn't really totally recognize what was going on, but he was very happy because his backache and everything, you know, disappeared. I went off to Austria, where I was about to go and work, and in the middle of the night woke up. I had this very strange experience of lying on my side, which I often, well, actually rarely do in bed, and felt as if I had two backbones. I mean, it was very odd. And when I got out of bed, I felt that I was bent over. And for the next 18 months, I assumed the posture of my father. And what I started to recognize was that the force of my genetics had been revealed by what I'd done with Dad, and that I had never recognized this in myself, this sort of pattern of, in a way, hunching over, making sure that my heart was protected. And so for 18 months or so, I had to really face this pattern of not opening my heart.
You had to own it.
I had to own it.
And it had been disowned.
Absolutely. And just to sort of finish the story, is that the backache eventually disappeared. And now, when I get that sort of ache in my back, it tells me that I'm hunched over metaphorically and, again, closing up my heart.
An early warning system.
Indeed.
Talking with Solaheen and Alicia Tom, co-authors of Being Human, Exploring the Forces That Shape Us and Awaken an Inner Life. So in this staff that's represented in the caduceus, you have integrity. In the snakes, you have the notion of flexibility. Can you elaborate on these and tell us about the other aspects of it as you've developed it and evolved it?
Well, integrity relates to the staff of the caduceus, which is about uprightness, our connection to ourself, our connection to the divine, our capacity to be aligned. And in our body, this is reflected by our spine, as Solaheen was talking about. Flexibility, the snakes, represent our capacity to transform, to move, to be in rhythm, to widen and expand, and have movement. And reflectiveness is what the wings represent, which is the capacity to, if you like, step back and get a different view of something, take a different perspective.
A bird's eye view.
Exactly. Or be illuminated from above, so to sort of widen our vision. And we have added two other components to the caduceus, which are a dove that represents surrender. And when we say surrender, we're not talking about surrendering to a feeling or a situation or something that's going on or another person, but surrender to the divine.
So there's not an arm, two arms up and a gun being pointed at someone when you're talking about this kind of surrender.
No.
Yeah. This is a wonderful sort of healing tool, and really might be the concept that's at the core of this work. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Yeah, it's very much. This symbolizes what brings us alive. The forces exist within us, and the five essential human qualities represented by the elements of the caduceus are what bring these forces alive within us and bring us truly alive. And whereas in the medical system, the caduceus is seen as an external symbol on something, we see this as something that we each embody within us to really understand it. There's a final piece of it that we have added, which is value, a symbol of a gem to represent value, which is what we are given. It comes from God. It's a sense of our own true value that's not based on what we do, how we look, what we've achieved in our life, but who we are and the real value of who that is. And that as we become aligned and as these parts of us really become alive, then we are able to really begin to sense our true value.
So the caduceus, as you work with it, is the staff with the snakes going around it. It's a winged staff, so the wings are above, mm-hmm. and then above it is a dove representing mm-hmm. surrender. Above that, a gem.
That's right.
Representing that final value, that internal, that gift that we have
mm-hmm. yes.
inside us. This notion of surrender, there you have had experiences with the spiritual group with which you are associated, the Subud, mm-hmm. right? And the process of surrender, according to this tradition, is the Latihan. Can you elaborate a bit about experiences that you might have had in surrender and what happened, the release? You've described in the book a couple of different experiences of this. And you often do this when you're stuck in a healing situation with a client or some other situation. It's like, okay, there's a block here. There's something bigger than us at work. Now is for us to realize that we're not in charge, that we have to surrender. Is that accurate?
Yes, and there is a difference between Latihan and surrender. surrender for us, and as we introduce it in the book and in our workshops, is really making space, making a time to be quiet, to open, to allow space for the unexpected, to offer up what we might be dealing with, and to allow the space for us to be shown what we need to see. And one of the ways that we got lots of practice was when we were actually writing the book. And with three of us writing the book, and two women and one man and one married couple and one person who wasn't, there were lots of opportunities for interesting dynamics and heated moments. And for us, it was a wonderful test of really needing to practice being human. We couldn't walk away and slam the door and not face what was going on. So when things got hard, we would surrender. All three of us would stop, would say, let's surrender, and really just become quiet and open ourselves to be shown what we needed to see, or just to allow ourselves to come back to a place of quietness where we could see from that place rather than from our anger or irritation or frustration or whatever else happened to be going on.
Which just keeps us in a very interesting sort of tape loop if we're in that situation. And yet with the notion of surrender being not yet the highest on this Caduceus model that you use, without surrender we cannot then get to that value.
That's right, that's right. I think for us, what we need to say is that in this action of surrender, when we let go of our thinking, and it's not sort of putting a hand metaphorically and, you know, to quieten our thoughts, it's just to let go of our thinking and to let go of outcome and to let go of beliefs and habits and what we feel and our sort of normal stance. That in this process of surrender, what really happens is that there's an integrity is recreated, a connection. So that's the staff. So in surrender, the staff is recreated. And what we hadn't probably really articulated in this conversation is that in us as humans, we see each other as a human. But what we don't see is that inside us, these various levels or forces become juxtaposed or they become out of order.
The animal might be on top in one case.
Indeed. Or the feelings. You know, lots of people have enormous feelings and emotions, and that's what rules them.
So then if one begins to recognize how these life forces manifest, how they sometimes get out of balance in ourselves and other people, mm-hmm. what we can then realize is compassion for another person because
Indeed.
They're working out of their vegetative self or they're working out of their material self.
Indeed. And it's the ability to recognize this in others and, of course, in a partnership in with one's wife or husband or children. It enables us not to be judgmental. It allows us to go, aha, that's what's happening. You know, there's many times when I recognize that I go, that's my dad, you know, or that's my mom, you know, or, oh gosh, I'm in my feelings. And so what we do, Alicia and I, is that we take a moment of surrender. And what that does is it brings that integrity back, which brings into alignment all those forces. Modern quantum physics talks about the universe as being self-organizing. And that the mind of God is throughout everything. And in a way, that's what happens, is that when we are in this place of surrender, we become organized yet again.
You know, this notion of surrender is very powerful, as I can see that. But then I can also leave this studio and go out in this town and see the bumper sticker that says, "These colors don't run," which manifested after September 11th. And as a Muslim living in America, you must have a very interesting perspective on what happened on September 11th and perhaps the missed opportunity, because you talk about surrender after September 11th in the United States of America, and, you know, they might start put you on some kind of enemies list, right? But can you tell us a little bit about the juxtaposition and the fact that as a country, if we don't, and I'm not saying surrender to forces who attacked us, but surrender to a divine force. Without this, we're not going to achieve our true value as a nation.
Absolutely. For my own self, and actually both, all three of us wrote a piece about 9/11 in the book. And for me, what happened was that when this terrible, terrible thing occurred, apart from, you know, feeling, oh my goodness me, this is terrible because this is Muslims who have done it, and bigoted and fundamental and frankly unlettered people, that I actually reckon I went straight into a place of quietness. It was actually quite profound. I wasn't torn away. I wasn't thrown into disarray. I actually became organized. It was a very, very profound experience. You know, and I felt, oh gosh, you know, I should be in my feelings. I should be, but I wasn't. I was in this absolutely still place. And what I recognized was that this was an opportunity for us as human beings to, in a place of quietness and surrender, that we can be illuminated and bring alive and bring order to our own lives and our own country and our own maps, so that we can encompass a broader, wider perspective of America with the global community rather than America and, you know, the rest. And so this sort of polarization of, you know, the West and the East actually can cease. And that was my hope. Whether this is actually happening or not, I'm not sure.
And Alicia, on a different level, I mean, we can't control the global perspective, whether, you know, the Americans get along with people in the Middle East. What we can control is our own actions and our own habits and what have you. And what September 11th has provided for many people is an opportunity to enlarge that map, that human map that we talked about at the beginning of the first interview. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think, again, what happened then was a tremendous opportunity for all of us to look at things in a different way. It really challenged everybody because something that was completely unexpected had happened. So you either get locked into the way that you see things, or you step back and take a view of it, you know, look at it from different angles, get a sense of what it might mean. And I think for a number of people it has been life-changing that it happened. And also to understand that those who may appear to become more rigid as a result of it, that to understand why that is, because it's usually from this fear of feeling threatened and challenged and unsafe makes people go into a protective, defensive mode. And so, as you said earlier, finding compassion for those who are not able to maybe expand how they see things or look at things in a different way, maybe try something different that we haven't done before, rather than resorting to the way we always tend to do things, which is to sort of take the cannons in.
Get stuck in that tape loop, yeah.
Yeah.
I have a sense that we could do a whole interview on this subject and how the life forces manifest in this post-911 America, but we're not going to start at the end of this interview. But I find it fascinating and see how it can be applied. And maybe that's something you'll write about in the future.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Thank you for being on the program. Continued success with your amazing work. We'll refer people to beinghumanbook.com for more information on the book and more information on your work. Toll free in the States, 800-304-4464. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Solihin and Alicia Tom have been our guests. Being Human, Exploring the Forces That Shape Us and Awaken an Inner Life is their new book.